War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello, everyone. Before we start the episode, I want to first put in a plug for a really great podcast by a friend of mine who's a really great guy. If you really want to understand the founding of the United States, you should listen to the American Revolution podcast. The host, Michael Troy, is going through the era from start to finish. He starts with a summary of the French and Indian War, then the pre-war protests, and finally into the Revolutionary War itself. The American Revolution podcast is more than just military history. It covers the political, social, and economic events that led to the United States becoming the first democratically elected government in modern history. You'll enjoy the detailed coverage of events, large and small, as well as the host's sense of humor through hundreds of episodes. Even if you know the American Revolution, you will definitely learn new things from this podcast. Michael even has a companion blog and a great book recommendation series. So check out the American Revolution podcast on all major podcast platforms. I'll tell you, I have listened to this podcast from the very beginning. I don't think I've ever missed a single episode. He's been at this for several years now, probably 5 or 6 years, and he's just released episode 265. So you can see the amount of detail he goes into, much, much more detail than I do. You will learn so much. You'll learn not just about the big and famous battles like Saratoga, Bunker Hill, those kind of battles, but you'll also learn about little-known engagements that, even though they're little-known, they're still very important. So again, check out the American Revolution podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts. Now, here is my main episode. Welcome to Key Battles of World War II in Europe, our 10,000-foot survey of the Second World War in Europe and the areas around it. I'm your host, James Early, as always. And my co-host, once again, is Sean McIver. Now, the European theater of the Second World War is an incredibly complex topic. The root causes of the war go all the way back to the First World War, if not earlier. And in order to fully understand the war, we can't just start with the German invasion of Poland on September 1st, 1939. We have to go further back than that. So in the first few episodes, Sean and I will narrate the key events in Europe between the World Wars. We will begin with the very end of World War I. All right, Sean, we're embarking on a major task here. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, I am. And, you know, we've got a lot of ground to cover. And so we've got to fly at high altitude on this one.
We are, yes. Listener, just so you'll know, we're not going to go into all the nitty gritty. And this is not going to be a 200, 300 episode podcast. There certainly are those out there. There's several good World War II podcasts where they do go into great detail. But that's not us. We're giving purposely deliberately giving a high-flying overview. So let's begin. At 11 a.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918, for the first time in 4 years and 3 months and 2 weeks, warfare that was more savage, bloody, and destructive than any the world had ever known stopped. At its height, the Great War, or the World War, as it was called at the time, encompassed fighting and killing, often along static lines and fought over yards and feet of ground rather than miles, from the Belgian coast of the English Channel to Switzerland, across Alpine ranges, throughout the troubled Balkan states, through the forests and plains of Poland, Galicia, Silesia, and Prussia, in the Caucasus Mountains, and in the Holy Land, the Levant, and Arabia in the Middle East. Fighting waged on the high seas and below it, in the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Indian Oceans, as well as in the Mediterranean, Black, and Baltic Seas, and even in the very skies above. Colonial powers battled in Africa and in China, and the nations of the Old World and the New saw themselves drawn into the conflagration.
The death toll was staggering, with some estimates coming in as high as over 40 million casualties, including 10 million military dead and 20 million soldiers wounded. There were more than 10 million direct civilian casualties in the war, and there was several great calamities that resulted directly from the war itself, including the 1918 and 1920 influenza pandemic, the Armenian genocide in Turkey, and the wartime famines that affected nations occupied by the enemy powers. This staggering number also does not account for the tens of millions killed or who perished in the Russian Revolution and Civil War, which was another direct outcome of the Great War. It was aptly described by American author Ernest Hemingway, who had served as an ambulance driver during the war, when he said it was the most colossal, murderous, mismanaged butchery that has ever taken place on Earth.
Now, when the fighting ceased and the guns stopped firing, the feeling among the Allies, that is the UK, France, and the United States, Italy, Japan, Belgium, Luxembourg, Greece, and the exiled Serbian government, was exhilaration for some of the victors, but stunned and weary relief for the majority. For the defeated Central Powers, including Germany, Austria-Hungary, Turkey, and Bulgaria, there was far less excitement. There was confusion, shock, resignation, and dismay among all parties because the ending had come so swiftly, all out of proportion for what had gone on before.
This war had involved an initial few months of war of maneuver. Static fronts then evolved in the form of thousands of miles of trenches and stayed that way for nearly 4 years with little movement, only brutal bloodshed and misery. In 1917, after mismanagement, stalemate, and horrendous privation, the Russian Empire, which was one of the Allied powers, collapsed into revolution. And by October of that year, the communists had taken power and had withdrawn from the war, just as the United States of America was finally drawn into the conflict by the unrestricted submarine warfare campaign conducted by Germany to try to starve out the British from the war. Germany sought to strike fast to finally win the war on the ground before American forces reached Europe in sufficient numbers, and they did break through the static lines and once again threatened Paris in the spring of 1917. However, the French, British, and the first newly arrived American troops stopped the German advance near Paris, which was not far from where they turned them back in 1914. By late summer, the Allied forces were ready to launch their own offensive across all fronts, and it was clear that the Central Powers had nothing left in the tank.
Now, among the Central Powers, Bulgaria was the first to fall, seeking an armistice in late September when their front in Macedonia collapsed. Ottoman Turkey capitalized in late October after a British and Arabian offensive routed Turkish forces in Palestine. The Austrian Empire, already teetering on the brink of defeat, reeled before a massive Italian, British, and French offensive and sued for peace on November 3rd. German lines on the Western Front had been broken in September by huge offenses by French, British, and especially by American troops, and their forces were being steadily pushed back toward the German borders. It was this steady defeat that ultimately broke the nerve of the German civilian and military leadership and caused them to seek terms with the Allies for an armistice to stop the fighting. Allied leadership ultimately offered them the terms that amounted to unconditional surrender. Germany had no choice but to accept.
Now, almost from the beginning of the armistice, the peace was an uneasy and flawed one, and it only got worse as it was formalized. Initially, as part of the terms of the armistice, German troops had to surrender their weapons and were to retreat from the occupied territories in Belgium, Luxembourg, Romania, and even from the Alsace-Lorraine regions, which Germany had taken from France after their 1870 war. Allied troops occupied the industrial and defensive regions in the Saar and the Rhineland. The German high seas fleet, as well as all submarines, were interred by the British Navy, and its air force was grounded. Austria and Turkey suffered similar occupations, and both empires collapsed and were broken into component parts, or in Turkey's case, large parts of territory seized by the Allies. Germany itself lost its emperor as Kaiser Wilhelm abdicated and fled to Holland, allowing a new republic to form in Germany.
The peace treaty negotiations in Versailles, in France, which stretched from January to July of 1919, were long and painful for the Germans. It was clear that, despite the lofty goals of American President Woodrow Wilson to build a peace without victory, the French especially intended to extract a huge measure of vengeance on Germany, to create what economist John Maynard Keynes called a Carthaginian peace, designed to break Germany to the extent that they would, this is Keynes, quote, undo what, since 1870, the progress of Germany had accomplished, end quote. France wanted a Germany that could never threaten her again, and they wanted guarantees from her allies that it would stay that way. Britain, on the other hand, favored a just peace that would make Germany pay for its part in causing the war, and make sure that Germany did not ever threaten it on the seas. But they wanted an economically viable trading partner. American President Woodrow Wilson had idealized ideas of liberty and self-determination, and he wanted a new global, or at least a European order, to ensure that peace was kept for the world. But he was sadly out of touch with what his countrymen back home wanted out of his treaty, with unfortunate long-term consequences. And I'm going to throw in a shameless self-plug here. If you want to learn more about World War I, you can listen to a podcast that I did with Scott Rank a couple years ago called Key Battles of World War I. It's an independent podcast. It's not part of Key Battles of American History, but it's limited in length. I think there's about 25 episodes. So we go into much more detail in that podcast about World War I.
And a fine podcast it is. We even talked.
Oh, thank you, Sean. You're very kind.
Yeah. You and I even talked about some World War I movies last year.
We did. That's right. Yes. Sean and I, in this podcast, that was the first series we had in this podcast, was movies like Sergeant York, All Quiet on the Western Front, Paths of Glory. So check that out too, listener, if you haven't already. If you're into movies and if you really want to get some idea of Hollywood's take on World War I.
In the end, Germany, which was racked already with socialist and communist uprisings and a completely wrecked economy, was forced to accept the Treaty of Versailles on June 28, 1919. They'd already disarmed, and so if they wanted to restart the war, they'd be at a definite disadvantage. Now, this was the fifth anniversary to the day of the assassination of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo, which was the event that had started this whole sorry mess. The treaty required Germany to accept sole and principal blame for the entire war. It stripped away the Alsatian Lorraine and returned them to France. Germany had to recognize the independence of Poland and the new Republic of Czechoslovakia, which was to its south, and they ceded parts of Upper Silesia, which is a part of central Germany, to Poland as a corridor to the Baltic Sea. East and West Prussia were separated by this corridor. Other small territories were ceded to Belgium, Czechoslovakia, and Denmark. Germany's African possessions were handed over to the new League of Nations, but they were mostly taken over by Britain and South Africa, while their possessions in the Central Pacific and its treaty port in China were taken over by Japan. Its South Pacific possessions were taken over by Australia. And as we saw in your Key Battles of History of World War II series, James.
Yeah, the Pacific War.
Pacific War, that is the Central Pacific and the South Pacific German possessions. There's a reason why the island is, you know, the Bismarck Sea is called such, because they just controlled that part of the Pacific. So be a very important part of the Pacific theater of the next war.
Yeah, it's the beginning of the Japanese Empire.
Yes.
And the Japanese developed a policy of, we just want our islands that we have now and the islands that are right next to them. Think about that, listener. Anyway, all right, back to Germany. The German army was restricted to no more than 100,000 active troops, which is way less than it had in World War I. And its general staff was dissolved and banned. The Navy was restricted in size to 6 old battleships, a few cruisers and destroyers, and submarines were expressly forbidden. The submarines had been a major thorn in the British and Allied side all throughout World War I, so we're going to just do away with submarines. I'm sure that's going to work great. Anyway, the Air Force was prohibited as well. The Rhineland was to be completely demilitarized, and all fortifications within 30 miles of the river were to be demolished. All stocks of weapons were ordered destroyed or decommissioned. The Rhineland and Saar regions would also be occupied by the Allies for another 15 years. That's tough.
It was Article 231 that was ultimately the most onerous. I love that word, onerous. And it had the most long-term consequences. The treaty required Germany to pay initially 226 billion gold marks, or nearly $1 trillion today. The amount was negotiated down, though, to only 132 billion gold marks, which is today about $500 billion.
Jump change.
Yeah, well, in all, the effect of the Treaty of Versailles was not one of triumph, but disappointment, resentment, and bitterness from all parties, except for those who were just completely delusional. Wilson hailed it as a triumph, but may have fallen into that latter camp. In the United States Senate, which was now controlled by the Republican Party, which Wilson was a Democrat, they refused to ratify the treaty. And the American public, disgusted with what they saw as European politics as usual, withdrew into an isolationist stance. The British public were dismayed by French vindictiveness and the harshness of the treaty terms. In France, there was celebration and satisfaction by the public, but more sober heads could see the failings of the treaty. Marshal Ferdinand Foch, who was, is it Foch or Foch?
Foch.
Foch, okay. Marshal Ferdinand Foch, who had been the supreme commander at the end of the war and argued for actually more punitive measures against the Germans, did observe, quote, "This is not peace. It is an armistice for 20 years. Pretty priestly.
Ah, a man with the gift of prophecy.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to be a prophet to see that coming.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, for Germany, it was one more blow to bear, one of many, for a country that had suffered catastrophic defeat, seeing the outlawing of a significant portion of their economy, that is the military sector, and was fighting for its life against internal revolution. It is difficult to see how anyone could have expected Germany to conceivably meet these terms. Within just a few years, they could make few payments, so France expanded their occupation to include the industrial heartland of the Ruhr in 1923, and in some cases, they simply shipped entire factories and raw materials back to France.
Eventually, the British negotiated a new payment plan for the Germans, which would enable them to pay between 1 and 2 billion marks per year. These payments to Britain and France would come in the form of loans from the United States. And for Britain, who was already paying back loans to the United States for her own war debt. In 1929, another plan was developed, which would let Germany make reparations through repayments through 1988. But again, American loans went to Germany to pay for her reparations. Winston Churchill, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1924 to 1925, it's sort of like the Secretary of the Treasury in the United Kingdom. He later wrote that he personally oversaw these exchanges in which he received promissory notes for millions of marks issued to Germany by United States bankers, which were handed to Britain and then sent back along to the United States government. He stated in The Gathering Storm that, quote, during the 3 years, 1926 to 1929, the United States was receiving back in the form of debt installment indemnities from all quarters about one-fifth of the money which she was lending to Germany with no chance of repayment. However, everybody seemed pleased and appeared to think that this might go on forever, end quote. And Churchill went on to state, quote, history will characterize all these transactions as insane.
Yes.
He has a gift for words, for sure.
Yes, and he was right, too. He wasn't always right about things, but here he definitely is. So, yeah, for her part, Germany spent the 1920s racked with political and economic instability. The return of millions of soldiers who were found themselves out of work and lacking purpose or reason for existence was a major problem. Hyperinflation caused money in Germany to become worthless. Unemployed veterans and workers gravitated to the left or to the right extremes. Radical socialist, communist, and anarchist groups like the Spartacists were inspired by the Russian Revolution to seize control in Germany from the weak Weimar Republican government, and large numbers of soldiers and sailors joined them. Other groups of soldiers retained their uniforms, if not their official status, and formed Freikorps, or free companies of paramilitary militias, and they fought the communists in bloody street battles. They also resented the Weimar Republic. Not many people liked it. They were suppressed by the government, but eventually they joined forces with other street-level nationalist extremists, including the National Socialist German Workers' Party, which had been formed in Bavaria by veterans, anti-communists, and anti-Semites. By the early 1920s, was led by a fanatically charismatic former corporal named Adolf Hitler. And we will have much more to say about him in a subsequent episode. James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Yes, so while the German government tried to pay off its reparations and maintain its civil control, the German military, which was called the Reichswehr, or National Defense, was headed by General Hans von Seck, worked as hard as possible to circumvent the Treaty of Versailles without actually appearing to do so. Seck recognized that Germany was bound to rearm at some point and war would return, and he worked to secretly prepare for the return of the Imperial Army. He was a monarchist. The army, which was only allowed to have a limited number of officers, was transformed into a cadre designed to be ramped up in time of war. Enlisted men were trained to be officers, lower-ranked officers trained for higher command. A general staff was created, but it was given a different, innocuous name. They were forbidden from having a general staff, so they just called it something else. They call it like the Office of Personnel Bureau or something like that. Cars and trucks simulated tanks and maneuvering. Glider clubs were formed throughout Germany to allow pilots to receive initial training. Former German armaments factories moved to neutral countries, such as the artillery manufacturer Krupp, which moved to Sweden, and Fokker, which moved to Holland.
Pretty sneaky.
Yeah.
Well, most importantly, even though Siegfried and his officers were strident anti-communists, they made an agreement in 1922 with the Soviet Union to exchange support in the development of Soviet industry and training for the Red Army for German officers and troops to train on Soviet soil, where tank, artillery, and aviation tactics could be developed in secrecy. Thus, the seeds of Blitzkrieg were planted in the steppes of Russia. Isn't that ironic?
Stridently anti-communist, so let's make an agreement with the communists. I guess.
Why not? Realpolitik at its best.
Yeah, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. So, well, by 1924, the Weimar Republic entered a period of relative stability. Hyperinflation was addressed by introducing a new adjusted currency. The Dawes Plan and American loans aided with reparations. Socialist revolution was put down, as was an attempted coup by right-wing reactionaries, including one by the Nazi Party in Munich. Peace and stability treaties and agreements were made with the nations on our borders, and in 1926, Germany was admitted into the League of Nations. Strict disarmament control by the Allies was sort of officially ended in 1927. The Navy began expanding within its legal limits, and a German airline, the Deutsche Lufthansa, today's Lufthansa, was formed in 1926. The economy was picking up, and there was more employment, and there was a large amount of social and political freedom in the Weimar era. And actually, I think that's kind of what we remember most the Weimar era for, is sort of the social freedoms that people had, and even some of the excesses that, you know, if you look at the film Cabaret, it's set at the end of the Weimar era, so or the musical Cabaret. So I think that's kind of what we remember the Weimar most for, other than its end.
Yeah, the Roaring Twenties reached Germany as well as the U.S.
Yeah.
However, it wasn't to last. Nope. As we all know, something happened in 1929. A little economic problem called the Great Depression. And in the end, the global economic collapse caused by the Great Depression, which began in the United States in October 1929, would strike Weimar Germany particularly hard. The German economy was propped up by American loans. And when the American economy collapsed, so too did Germany's ability to pay its reparations. This resulted in German and Austrian banks failing, which in turn resulted in businesses failing and unemployment skyrocketing. Within a year, all the progress of the previous years was gone, and Germany was on the verge of collapse. In the 1930 election, predictably, the Communist Party gained seats in the German parliament, but the Nazi Party gained 20% of the parliamentary vote. Germans were turning to the extremes, and the fringe far-right party from Bavaria, led by the loud little man with the funny mustache, was ready to provide the German people with an answer to the question of, how did we get here, and how do we make Germany what it was again? All right, so let's just have some free discussion about it for a little bit, Sean, shall we?
Yeah, so, you know, I think that the Treaty of Versailles, you know, there is a straight line from the gun stopping on November 11, 1918, and the German tanks rolling on September 1st of 1939. You know, there's a clear and well-defined line between those two events. And, you know, this is the World War II, the World Wars are really one war that as Foch said, has a 20-year armistice.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. It's sometimes said today that you could think of World War I and World War II as kind of like a second 30 years war with a long kind of armistice in the middle.
Yeah. Yeah. Really.
So you agree with that?
I would agree with that statement. You know, because the 30 years war is a good comparison because the sides changed multiple times during the war.
Right.
The war started as a conflict, you know, 30 years war started as a conflict between Lutheran states and Catholic states in the German Empire. And it ended as a conflict between Spain and France that was fought in Germany.
Yeah.
So you had Protestant, France was supporting some of the Protestant states, and you had some of the Protestant states fighting for the empire still, you know, when they'd previously been fighting against. So there was multiple, you know, that's, I think that's a good analogy if you'd had a long break in the middle. You know, the Hundred Years' War between England and France was really just a series of wars that took place with long agnos. But, you know, the World War II, you know, is still ultimately, until 1941, World War II is still a European conflict, just like until 1917, the First World War was largely a European conflict. There was fighting elsewhere. It was a global war, but the if you look at a heat map of the war, of the world, you know, the heat map is definitely centered in Europe, Western and Eastern Europe. So we will see in our exploration of World War II that the conflict spread much wider in this Second World War, but still, ultimately, you know, that the last all-European war was from 1939 until 1941. You know, that was really the key conflict. So, I think the roots of the Second World War, definitely the roots of the Second World War, are keenly in the First World War. The Treaty of Versailles was a negotiated peace that solved no problems that were created, that were existing in 1914. It merely sought to shave down what were perceived by some as the edges that caused the conflict, you know, German militarism and Austrian instability and Austrian, you know, insecurity around, you know, the Balkans and Turkey's descent as a major world power. Those things, the Treaty of Versailles tried to capitalize on those and then went entirely the wrong direction. You know, a economically crippled Germany and militarily neutered Germany without the willingness to maintain that for multiple generations until the hurt feelings went away was never going to not result in another war. And that's what Foch, I think, saw.
Yeah, and another similarity between this one and the 30 Years' War, you know, including World War I, is, as you alluded to earlier, in the 30 Years' War, there were a lot of strange bedfellows.
Yeah.
You know, people allying with other countries that they had no business allying with, or at least they, you know, you wouldn't have expected it. You know, France sticking up for the Protestant. France is this kingdom that has a history of persecuting its own Protestants. And
Cardinal Richelieu was the leader. He was the one who pushed to do that. And he's a cardinal of the Church. Yeah.
Flexible. And so here in this war, we see originally Germany and the Soviet Union going to join together in an alliance, even though their two leaders detested each other. And they were on opposite ends of the political spectrum, but at the same time, they had in common, they were totalitarian states. And then that falls apart, and essentially Russia changes sides because it's stabbed in the back by Germany. And then you have Russia, this totalitarian communist state, allying with two democracies.
Yeah.
You know, the British and the French, and then the French are knocked out, and then you get the Americans, and, you know, technically Britain's not even really technically a democracy. It's a parliamentary monarchy, although it has a lot of democratic institutions and principles. So you have three completely different nations when you get to the big three, all put together because they had to.
Yeah. Well, and that, you know, the thing is, as you see in the 1920s is, you know, you see this treaty being negotiated where France is bound and determined that they're going to take their pound, they're more than their pound of flesh. They're going to take all the flesh that they can get. Britain just wants us, you know, Britain is mostly focused on making sure that the German naval power is broken, but they want an economically viable Germany because Germany has lots of resources and it has large population. And so they want a stable Germany, and so Britain has that idea. France has another idea. Wilson has an idea of what he wants. He wants this grand vision for a new world order, and his people back home are disgusted by the whole thing. And you know, support for the war, you know, existed and it quickly disappeared. And as soon as the armistice happened, everybody was like, okay, bring the boys home. And when they were coming home, all of a sudden they also were bringing home, you know, Spanish flu, which spread like wildfire in the United States and all over the world. People were sick. And the president is in France, you know, he got a lot of heat from this, from the, even his own party we're abandoning the, you know, the Washingtonian ideal, which is let the Europeans take care of themselves, you know. And there had been isolationism before the Americans joined the war in 1917, but popular opinion about the submarine campaign and as well as the Zimmerman telegram, which brought America into the war, there was a lot of support for the war, but it quickly died down. The other thing to think about is that Churchill wrote in 1919, the offensive of 1919 was going to be a nightmare for Germany. That some of the things that the British and the French and the Americans, Americans built hundreds of tanks, were building hundreds and thousands of tanks that they were going to ship over to France. The British were building brand new tanks. They were just preparing to deploy the largest bombers that they'd ever had. They were actually 4-engine bombers, and they were going to go start bombing Berlin. In 1918, Churchill even wrote that there was plans for paratroopers to be used in the First World. People don't know that. In 1919, they would have assaulted the Rhine. They would have assaulted the Germans if they had stopped at the Rhine and not had an armistice. They would have gone over the Rhine with paratroopers in 1919. So, you know, it would have been annihilation for the Germans if they had kept fighting, you know, even, you know, after from November, you know, into the spring of 1919. The Germans knew this. The German high command knew this. Their armies were retreating, but they were retreating in good order. And there was no American troops. There was no British troops. There's no French troops in Germany. They were still in Belgium and in France. And so that's what, you know, the public of Germany was kept clueless of this because the German state had a tight lid on the press. And so even though the men in the Navy were mutinying and refusing to take part in anything because there was a plan to send the Navy out on a last death ride to fight the British and, you know, go down fighting, the Navy mutinied and said, we're not going to do that. The Army was retreating in good order, but they were getting beaten in the field, but the people at home didn't know that. It was a strategic withdrawal. So when the government collapsed and lost its nerve, they truly lost its nerve, and the people saw that as this massive betrayal. And that was never addressed, and the Allies never took any time to address that to the German people. It was a falsehood that was allowed to fester. And then it was made worse by the nightmarish inflation and the reparations. You know, the idea that all of our money that we're making is going to Germany. And what Germany, most of German reparations that France got was they went in and they took factories out of the Rhineland and they moved them to France.
Right.
They took all the product of entire coal mines and took them back to France to rebuild their steel industry. So, all these things that were happening in Germany, the German public did not realize how close they were to collapse in terms of the home front was close to collapse. They knew that they had shortages of food and things, but Germany remained largely patriotic and largely supportive of the war. Whereas France very nearly pulled out of the war in 1917 because its troops stopped fighting. And the people back home could see that. They could see, you know, their men were coming home for leave and were miserable and were saying it's murder out there. So I think it was a very different situation in France and Germany to a lesser extent. United Kingdom and Germany, you know, United Kingdom nearly starved to death because of the submarines. So it was very different in Germany. And that's a situation that is not addressed by the Allies. They merely are, you know, in France's case, are seeking to punish Germany and make sure that Germany is punished. Austria and Hungarian Empire is completely split up into multiple components. It no longer is a factor anymore in European politics. Turkey has got its, you know, its traditional ancient territories taken from it, and now it's only just the Asia Minor state of Turkey, and it can transforms itself through governmental change. It no longer is an empire; it's now an autocratic state. So, that's the scenario that we have in the 1920s, and so the United States wants to stay out of the Europe, but at the same time, they're wanting to make money, and so they know that England can pay them back if they make loans to Germany, and they'll pay England, and then England and France will pay America back, and they'd circulate money. And I don't know how that works, but somehow they felt like it was working to have an economically viable Germany in some form. And then the Depression hits. And suddenly American bankers have no money to loan to German industry because the American bankers don't have banks anymore. You know, the banks all failed.
Right.
You know, there's no money. And so that, I think, you know, the 1920s, you see this excess all around and you see this delusion all around. And, you know, France is willing to be harsh to Germany for a while, and then it gets old after a while and everybody kind of agrees, okay, let's let Germany pull herself up. And if maybe if the economic collapse in 1929 doesn't happen, maybe Germany might head back towards some type of, you know, parliamentary system, maybe at some point talk about restoring the monarchy, you know, restoring another noble German house to the monarchy rather than the Hohenzollern, so, or rather than the Kaiser Wilhelm. But it doesn't happen.
Before we wrap up.
Yeah, and that's it.
James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors.
Let's talk a little more about the Treaty of Versailles. I just had a thought, and that is that, you know, I've taught on this in as part of my courses that I teach for many years, and I've always thought, especially about France, you know, how could France be so stupid as to impose or demand such harsh penalties, such a huge financial payment, the loss of territory, the demilitarization, the minimization of the German military forces. And I always have kind of judged France and their leaders and thought they should have just given them a defeat with honor, right? Don't punish them so harshly. But I realize in thinking about it just now that I've got 20/20 hindsight, of course, but what we have to keep in mind is that several things. Number one, this war had, in the Western Front at least, had been fought almost entirely in France. You know, France, their land suffered far greater than did the UK or did Germany, because there wasn't any fighting on UK soil. There were some bombings and things like that, but there wasn't much fighting in Germany. The French people and the land, as I said, suffered greatly. And then let's not forget also that this is the second time, we're talking about World War One. It's the second time in a few decades that Germany had invaded France.
Yes.
We can't forget that the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, in which Germany just marched in and basically kicked the French's rear end, right?
And not only that, James, but I mean, John Maynard Keynes can very well sums it up, but Germany was harsh on France in 1871.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Exceedingly harsh. They took two of the beloved territories of France away from them, and some of the most beautiful parts of France that had German populations, and the Alsace had a large German population. The Lorraine had almost none, but they took them anyway. And they imposed draconian reparations on France, that because if Germany invaded France, but France provoked the war. Germany provoked France into declaring war, but, you know, that was all Bismarck's deal with Napoleon III. But regardless, they imposed draconian reparations on France, and France stunned everyone by paying them off early. France basically transformed its economy and its military and its spending and everything, and produced enough money to quickly repay the reparations. It was a matter of pride for them that they did so. But they held a grudge, and they held a 40-year grudge.
It's more than 40 years.
Almost 50 years, but they held that grudge.
Well, yeah. Yeah. My point is that also this region, this kind of borderland area between Germany and France, Alsace, Lorraine and other areas, Germans and French had been fighting over it for 1,100 years.
Yeah, exactly.
You could go all the way back to when Charlemagne's kingdom broke up into three regions.
That's true. But, I mean, they saw it as turnabout is fair play. And as we will see in a few episodes, the Nazi Germany also felt the next time around turnabout was fair play. So we'll see specifically some of the things that they did to humiliate France because of that. So, but you know, think about it. The German Empire was declared in Versailles, in that room where that treaty was signed. You know,
Yes.
In the I believe it was the Hall of Mirrors is what it's called. And that was where that treaty, that this is where this treaty was signed. So there was deliberate measures taken to make sure in both cases. Yeah. And Versailles, of course, was the palace of the kings of France and of Louis the 14th and Louis the 16th. So, you know, the German Empire was declared there. The Germans were humiliated there at Versailles, you know, in 1919 with the treaty.
Yeah.
So,
and yeah, to piggyback on what you were saying just then, France had you can't judge France, and I shouldn't, and I don't anymore, because France had no way of knowing there was going to be an economic depression. They had no way of knowing. All they were thinking about was never again. You know, this is twice now, and we can never have a third German humiliation of France. Right.
But, and that's the thing, is that you're more level heads. I mean, what Foch wanted was to break up Germany to back to what it was in the 18th century, you know, mm-hmm. multiple small states. He wanted to break up even more than, you know, what Napoleon had tried to do, which was set up just a loose confederation that had no military power whatsoever. So his idea was make there be no Germany, make there be Bavaria and Saxony and Wittelsburg and things like that again, you know. And, you know, he felt like they could take care of Prussia by, you know, splitting it up and having Poland be, you know, a buffer state. The other thing that is interesting, that we don't really talk about it much, but the big boogeyman of 1919 is the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Is the Bolsheviks. And they were, you know, Russia was excluded from the Treaty of Versailles. They were not part of that because they had signed their own peace with Germany. They'd pulled out of the war, and the Allies saw that as a betrayal in a lot of ways, but they also were terrified of revolution, socialist revolution spreading. And, you know, right, the writings of Karl Marx and of many of the other revolutionists, the socialist and communist revolutionists of the 19th century, were about Germany. Germany was to be ground zero for the dictatorship of the proletariat that Marx wrote about in the Communist Manifesto and in Das Kapital. It was not a state like Russia. Russia was an aberration in that it was not a modernized industrial state. It was kind of a different previous state. And the Bolsheviks really, and Lenin really transformed that and applied the socialist revolution to communist revolution to Russia. But even Lenin and Trotsky, their goals were extend the revolution into Germany. And so that's where you get those communist revolts in 1918 and into the 1920s, and the fighting between reactionary elements, right-wing elements against the left-wing, war in the street, civil war, basically, in Germany. And I think a lot of Britain's concern with Germany and making Germany stable was that, you know, poor unemployed people go to extremes. Unemployed, desperate people go to extremes, and they were very concerned that, you know, the extreme they would go to be picking up arms for the Red Cause, and they did. In a lot of cases, the Spartacists and other communists did take up arms in Germany, and so that was a concern with getting Germany stable, and definitely through the 1920s, is eventually, you know, you got to have Germany stable because Germany, as well as Poland, is a buffer against the Soviet Union.
Well, all right. Good discussion. And that's going to wrap it up for us. In our next two episodes, we're going to be talking about the further development of situations. We're going to look at political developments in Italy, Germany, and then the rise of fascism throughout Europe, and then the rise to power of Adolf Hitler and his many territorial grabs. And we're going to go right up to the brink of war. So join us at our next episode, which we're going to call The Gathering Storm. We'll see you then. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, This American President by Richard Lim, Eyewitness History by Josh Cohen, and Vlogging Through History by Chris Mowry. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are four things you can do. First, you can subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcasts. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you can join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for key battles of American history. There are five different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes, and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Colonels Lee Beaumont, Terry Davis, and Josh Simpson, Majors Chris C., Alex Calabres, Anna Concepcion Castro, Eli Forsyth, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jay Robison, Captains Ryan Apashian, Alex Coombs, Robbie Edwards, Rick Hanna, Jeff Henley, Grant Holmstrom, Hooves Woodworking, Stephen James, Mike Leslie, Gary Lenz, Billy Malone, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Ryan Ramones, David Santee, Michael Severino, Jacob Thomason, Jeff Vandermeulen, and Gregory Works. And Lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Scott Hendricks, Who's Your Daddy, David Lueza, Craig Martin, Jeff Sabo, and Larry Elk. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.